This conference is being recorded.
Okay, let's get started. My name is Sarah Barzak, and I'm the Program Director for our High-Risk Energy Choices Program at the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. First, I'd like to thank you for attending today. We are very pleased to connect with you because you make our work possible. This webinar is a great opportunity to learn and ask questions. We have an excellent presenter today who many of you know, Michelle Boyd. She's the director of the Safe Energy Program for Physicians for Social Responsibility. Michelle is going to talk about the various provisions in the climate and energy legislation currently before Congress that unfortunately provide massive subsidies to the nuclear power industry. There has been a lot of activity going on in D.C., and she is going to zoom in to some specifics that we are all very concerned about. Additionally, SAFE's Federal Policy Director, Jen Renix, will be available during the question and answer portion of the webinar. Michelle Boyd has an MS in Environmental Policy from the University of Michigan and a BS in Biology from Purdue University. She has done research on energy policy in Eastern Europe and Russia. Before PSR, Ms. Boyd was Legislative Director of Public Citizens Energy Program, and prior to that, she was Managing Editor of Energy and Security and Global Outreach Coordinator at the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research. Before IER, Ms. Boyd worked at the Earth Island Institute in San Francisco, and she's lucky enough to speak both Russian and French. We'd like to get Michelle through her presentation before taking questions. You can submit questions by writing them in, and I'll take them from the queue at the end. We are recording this session, and it, along with Michelle's presentation, will be available on our website under webinars at www.cleanenergy.org. And with that, I'm going to hand this over to Michelle. Michelle?
Thanks so much, Sarah. I really appreciate the opportunity to do this webinar to talk about the nuclear subsidies. If you'll note, I call this talk Nuclear Subsidies So Far in the Climate Energy Bill. And the reason that I say so far is because we are only partway through the process. And unfortunately, we already have some subsidies in the bills, and they're talking about adding more. So if we want to start with the nuclear subsidies in the House Climate Bill, the House Climate Bill is called the American Clean Energy and Security Act, or ACES for short, and it's H.R. 2454. It passed the House just barely, but it passed the House 219 to 212 on June 26th of this year. The nuclear subsidies in that bill include what's called a Clean Energy Deployment Administration, or CEDA for short, and I'm going to spend a lot of time on that. It also excludes new nuclear from the Renewable Electricity Standard baseline, and I'm also going to talk more in depth about that. It includes a study on thorium fuel. I'm not going to go into depth on that issue, but basically it tells the DOE to look at the question of whether thorium fuel is a viable fuel for moving forward with nuclear power in the United States. It also includes Manufacturing Revolving Loan Fund Program, and that program includes nuclear as a possible recipient of these loans. And then finally, it includes allocation funding for international technology deployment, including nuclear power. The nuclear subsidies in the Senate Energy Bill. The Senate Energy Bill is called the American Clean Energy Leadership Act, S-1462, and it passed out of the Energy Committee on June 17th. This bill is going to be combined with the Senate climate bill, and that climate bill is not public yet. It is supposed to be released on September 8th or thereabouts. So we have a climate part of this bill. We have the energy bill. But this energy bill is absolutely chock full of nuclear subsidies. The nuclear subsidies in the energy bill include CEDA, the Clean Energy Deployment Administration. And this version is very different than the House version, and I'm going to talk about those differences because they're very important. Actually, the Senate version of this bill is a nuclear and coal slush fund. It also excludes new nuclear from the Renewable Electricity Standard baseline, and I'm going to explain that. It includes a set stating the strategic role of nuclear power, and I will go into more detail about that as well. It includes language that develops reprocessing and sets radiation standards for reprocessing facilities. There's also a Commission on Radioactive Waste of 11 people who will look at the question of what are we going to do with our spent fuel and highly radioactive waste, and are supposed to put out a report in 2 years. It authorizes $5.17 billion in nuclear energy R&D, including reprocessing. It reauthorizes Nuclear Power 2010. Nuclear Power 2010 is the industry, government, or industry taxpayer co-pay program for paying for licenses for new reactors. The Senate version also includes nuclear workforce development and training, and it includes DOE authority to enter into R&D and development contracts. So it increases the DOE Secretary's authority. So I'm going to walk through most of these subsidies with you so that you can understand them better. The issue right now in the Senate, of course, is the climate bill and how are they going to get a cap-and-trade program passed by the Senate. One of the suggestions is to sweeten the bill with nuclear subsidies. And one of the main points I want people to walk away with today is that this bill is already chock full of nuclear subsidies. But before I go into the subsidies, I do just want to touch on the fact that carbon trading will benefit the nuclear industry. Any allowance allocation, so this is any money that, or any allowances or the carbon ability, they give you permission to emit carbon. So any allocation will likely result in a windfall profits for merchant generators. Merchant generators are those who produce and sell electricity at market rates. These are in states that are in deregulated markets. Works is that in order every hour, electricity prices are set based on generator offers. The price of the electricity ends up being the most expensive generator needed to meet baseload. So whoever comes in at the end and fills up baseload, everybody gets paid at that price. And this means that anybody who came in below that makes a profit. So making coal plants more expensive to pollute will mean that that last little bit will be a higher price. And for non-emitters, you know, we can argue whether nuclear is a non-emitter, but under the bill they are considered a non-emitter. They will benefit more. Why? Because they won't have any increased cost to pay. They don't have to buy allowances to emit CO2. So they are going to benefit from carbon trading. And giving away allowances for free will increase these windfall profits. And so carbon trading not only will benefit the nuclear industry, but a case study by Exelon estimates that carbon pricing will actually add $700 to $750 million to Exelon's annual revenues for every $10 per metric ton increase in the price of CO2 allowances. Therefore, at $15 per metric ton of CO2, this is equivalent to a windfall of $1 billion per year. So the nuclear industry is going to benefit regardless of whether or not there are all these additional subsidies in the bill. So now I just want to walk through what the subsidies are. What is the Clean Energy Deployment and Administration? And in both bills, the purpose of the CEDA is to promote access to affordable financing for accelerated and widespread deployment of clean energy, energy infrastructure, energy efficiency, and manufacturing technologies. Both nuclear power and coal are eligible under the definition of clean energy technology in both the House and Senate versions of these bills. The structure of CEDA is slightly different in the House and Senate. In the House, the board is made up of the administrator, which is a person that they hire from the outside, and the Secretaries of Energy, Treasury, Interior, and Agriculture, plus four additional members appointed by the President with the consent of the Senate. The Senate version is slightly different. The board includes the administrator, the DOE secretary, and seven members appointed by the President with the consent of the Senate. These are for 5-year staggered terms, and they can be reappointed. There's a bit more about CEDA. Continued. Both bills establish a Clean Energy Technology Advisory Council, and the purpose is to develop a methodology for assessing energy technologies and advising the board on the technological approaches to support CEDA, on how, and then the board gets to decide how to allocate the funding. In the House, these 8 members are selected by the Board of Directors. In the Senate, 5 are selected by the DOE and by the board. Again, they are 5-year staggered terms and can be reappointed. The Senate version merges the existing loan guarantee program called Title 17, this was the program authorized in the Energy Policy Act of 2005, with CEDA. So it becomes one entity. The House version does not merge those two programs, and it does prohibit double dipping. This was a provision added at the 11th hour. I think it's a very important provision that prevents company from going to both Title 17 and to CEDA to fund the same project. But there are really significant differences between the House and Senate versions of CEDA, and I'm going to talk about the three most important differences. Most important, the Senate version allows these nine people to give unlimited loan guarantees. This means that they can give out, if they so choose, $2 trillion worth of loan guarantees. I don't think they will. But they have no cap on how much they can give out in loan guarantees. And the reason why they're allowed to give out unlimited loan guarantees is because it exempts CEDA from one line of the Federal Credit Reform Act, Section 504B. The House version does not include this exemption. Therefore, CEDA has to go to Congress and get authorization to give out loan guarantees. This is an extraordinarily important provision. We do not want nine unelected people able to give out unlimited loan guarantees. It is very important that Congress have a say in how much debt the U.S. taxpayer has out at a given time. The second most important difference is that the Senate allows one technology to get the lion's share. It does not cap how much one technology can get out of CEDA. So for very expensive technologies like coal and nuclear, they could potentially get the vast majority of whatever loans and other financial support is given out because they're so expensive and, in the case of nuclear, so risky. The House, on the other hand, caps at 30% the value of CEDA. So, for example, if the administration goes to Congress and says, we want to give out $100 billion worth of loan guarantees, only 30% can go to one technology. That means the bank has to focus on various technologies and can't just support the most expensive and risky technologies. And finally, one of the most important differences between the House and Senate versions is that the Senate does not a greenhouse gas metric. And what does that mean? Well, in the House, they require that CEDA prioritize projects that reduce greenhouse gases in the cheapest and fastest way. In the Senate, they don't even require that the projects reduce greenhouse gases, much less in the cheapest and fastest way. All three of these differences are incredibly significant. What are some of the other significant differences? Well, in the Senate version, it fails to require greenhouse gas reduction, as I mentioned. It makes loan guarantees more risky for taxpayers because it changes the existing law and allows multiple loan guarantees on the same technology at the same time, meaning that we could give out loan guarantees to the same nuclear design, to various different proposals for the same design. Turns out that design is horribly flawed, and yet we're on the hook as taxpayers for every single one of those defaults. It also allows risky indirect financial schemes, securitization, lending on the security of debt, et cetera. The House version does have indirect financial support, but they are mostly primarily limited to renewables and efficiency, especially efficiency, where the risk of default is much, much lower. The Senate version also fails to include risk management experience on the board. So there is not required or even suggested that somebody on that board should know how to calculate risk. The Senate version fails to require that the board recuse itself, a board member recuse itself in the case of financial gain. It allows DOE to set the credit rating, and I don't recall the last time DOE had any experience doing that. And finally, the Senate version supplies CEDA directly with $10 billion without congressional appropriations. So it doesn't authorize $10 billion, it just gives them $10 billion. There are a few other significant differences. In the House version, the House version codifies what they call conditional commitments before licenses are obtained. This means that the DOE can say, if you do X, Y, and Z, we promise to back your loans. But it require that these licenses are finalized before a guarantee, that licenses are given obtained before the guarantee is finalized. So although it does codify the conditional commitments, it is already what DOE is doing, and it does require that licenses be obtained first before those commitments can be finalized. The House version also requires prevailing industry wages to the administrator and four appointed board members. This is higher than the Senate version. The Senate version uses the current government pay and does have exceptions for if there's a particular person that they absolutely have to hire and can't find anyone else to do the job, they can potentially hire that person for 2 years at a higher salary. And then finally, and I think most importantly, the House version requires public transparency. This has been one of the biggest problems with the Title 17 program. There's been less than zero transparency. And the House version includes it requires an online database of projects, applications, financial transactions, requires annual reviews that are made public. So it's a very, very important provision. How does CETA increase the risk for U.S. taxpayers? Well, both the House and Senate provisions do certain things that do increase risk for U.S. taxpayers. First and foremost, they change the law so that taxpayers can share the subsidy cost with borrowers. What is a subsidy cost? The subsidy cost is what a borrower or a company that wants a loan guarantee has to pay to the government in advance of getting this loan guarantee, and it's supposed to cover the risk of default. Under current law, taxpayers or the borrower must pay the subsidy cost, and in the case of nuclear, the assumption has been that the nuclear industry must pay the cost. With this particular provision, this cost can now be shared with taxpayers. This means that taxpayers now have skin in the game, even if the project doesn't fail. So it increases the risk of U.S. taxpayers because we're basically paying part of the risk cost. Calculating this risk is extremely difficult. According to GAO, the Government Accountability Office, and the Congressional Budget Office, it is more likely that DOE will underestimate the risk than overestimate it. What does that mean? It means that if the subsidy cost is too low and there are more defaults than expected, any difference between what was paid in the subsidy cost and the amount of defaults immediately comes out of the Treasury, no questions asked. No going to Congress and getting it appropriated, no going to the President and getting a signature. It is the full faith and credit of the U.S. Taxpayer, and we immediately pay it. So calculating this subsidy cost is extremely, extremely important. According to the Congressional Budget Office, the default rate for nuclear power plants is well above 50%. The industry thinks that they're going to pay a 1% subsidy cost. If they're paying a 1% subsidy cost and the risk of default is 50%, if you do the math, it doesn't work out so that the taxpayers are protected. And in fact, the taxpayers are paying out a lot. The bills also remove the U.S. taxpayer's right of first lien in the event of default. So the original Title 17 loan guarantee program requires that if a program defaults and you start selling off the assets, all the proceeds go to the U.S. government, and that helps those off the debt. But these bills, both the House and Senate versions of the CETA provision, change that so that taxpayers don't necessarily get the first right of lien, and that it requires the Department of Energy to make agreements in advance about how to divvy up the assets in the event of a default. One important result of this language is that cooperatives will now be able to obtain loan guarantees for new reactors. Before, DOE had said, we really can't do these agreements. It's too complicated for undivided interests, which are basically nuclear power plants. You can't divide into a bunch of bits and bobs. And so we're not interested in giving you loan guarantees. And according to the cooperatives, this language will give DOE the right to do that. So what are some of the other subsidies in these bills? Both the Senate and House bills exclude new nuclear from the baseline renewable electricity standard. What is the renewable electricity standard? It mandates that a state produce a certain percentage of renewable energy by a certain year. Both of the bills, as I said, exclude new reactors from the baseline. So that percentage of renewable is calculated based on how much electricity a state produces. if a state produces, I'm just making these numbers up, but if a state produces 10,000 megawatts of energy, it's required under the law to produce 15% of its energy from renewable, therefore it would have to produce 1,500 megawatts of renewable energy. However, if this state were to build a 1,000 megawatt nuclear reactor, so that it was producing 11,000 megawatts of energy, it would still only have to produce, and that X should be 1,500 megawatts from renewable energy. I apologize for the version on the web. So that's a bit confusing, but essentially if a state were to go down the nuclear path, they would not require them to produce more energy from renewables. If a state were to build, for example, a coal plant, they would have to produce more renewables. The Senate bill also includes what someone told me was nonsense of Congress, and it declares that nuclear power is a clean and secure domestic energy, which is this nonsense of Congress states is essential for the production of electricity and reducing greenhouse gases. It also states that spent fuel should be stored in limited number of secure centralized facilities, meaning move it off the sites to some random other place only to be moved again when there's a permanent site. It also states that reprocessing may reduce the burden on geologic repositories and that recycling and advanced reactors really means fast reactors, may reduce the volume and radioactivity of high-level waste. And then it reaffirms the policy of the United States to support the use and expansion of nuclear energy and to fulfill the federal obligation to deal with the spent fuel problem. There is also reprocessing in the Senate bill, and it's quite complicated, but it requires that DOE do certain things, and it moves us down the path of reprocessing. It does not require reprocessing as some of the other proposals have done. First, it requires DOE to prepare an integrated process flow sheet, essentially saying what waste is going to be of reprocessing and how to deal with all of the waste streams from all the reprocessing steps, and they have to characterize all those reprocessing steps. And then finally, they have to decide how they're going to deal with those waste streams, and they have to design disposal facilities for those waste streams. On completing those steps, which are quite complicated, DOE has to develop a generic environmental impact statement for reprocessing and then conduct design and engineering work that gets them to the point where they can give firm cost estimates. All of this moving us towards reprocessing. On the other hand, the language requires DOE to do something that it did not do under the Bush administration's Global Nuclear Energy Project, which was the proposal to restart reprocessing in the United States. And under that proposal and that environmental impact statement, the DOE did not do any characterization of waste streams and how they were going to manage them, nor did they give any cost estimate. So it's not ideal language because we certainly don't want to go down this path, but it does not set us up to actually reprocess. It also requires that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and the Environmental Protection Agency establish radiation standards for both worker and public exposure to radiation, specifically from a reprocessing facility. And then finally, it directs the Nuclear Energy Advisory Commission and the Nuclear Waste NWTRB, which now I'm not remembering what that stands for. It's a board, and they've been giving advice to DOE about Yucca Mountain to evaluate and report on the readiness of the reprocessing program. The Senate bill also includes nuclear research and development authorization funding, specifically $5.17 billion over 4 years. And these programs, all of these programs were authorized in the 2005 Energy Policy Act, and they include Nuclear Power 2010, where taxpayers pay the part of the cost of certifying reactor designs and licensing new reactors. Generation 4, which is a research and development program on new designs, including fast reactors, reprocessing R&D, and then also nuclear science and engineering fellowships and grants. The House version does not include this provision. So still to come, we still have the Senate climate bill. Where are we with that? Well, that bill is being written in the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee. There are some members of that committee who are very, very excited about nuclear power. That includes Carper from Delaware, Senator Cardin from Maryland. Probably, I would say, all of the Republicans on the committee, though most of those Republicans would not support a bill that included cap and trade, carbon cap and trade. So those negotiations are happening right now. Once that is done, the Senate energy bill, the Senate climate bill, and a couple other bills from various other committees are going to be combined into one big climate bill and go to the floor. And that will not happen definitely won't happen before the fall and may not happen until, November, December time period. We don't really have a sense exactly of the timing. And in that process, there's going to be more amendments. And Senator Carper has already made it clear that he intends to add nuclear subsidies into the climate bill and then go for more on the floor. So we have a big, there's going to be a lot of effort to add more nuclear subsidies to this bill. And what other nuclear subsidies could be added? Well, certainly the loan guarantee program in the Senate energy bill is the biggest thing that the industry has to have. They definitely will not build without these loan guarantees. But there's other things that could be added, for example, allocation funding to the Clean Energy Deployment Administration or directly to loan guarantees for nuclear. Allocation money could be used to pay for subsidy costs. None of this, of course, the PSR, Physicians for Social Responsibility, supports any of these, but these are all just potential additional subsidies. Nuclear could be defined as a renewable energy in the renewable electricity standard, which would mean that if a state were to build a nuclear power plant, it would be count as their renewable electricity that they're producing. There could be mandatory interim storage, an effort to get mandatory interim storage, off-site storage. There could be an effort to get mandatory reprocessing. There could be more production tax credits authorized or risk insurance authorized, even though none of them have actually been used by the nuclear industry because they haven't gotten to the point of producing anything or building anything. There could be more R&D authority or more R&D authorization, more Nuclear Power 2010 authorization. Further streamlined licensing is another possibility, subsidies for parts manufacturing, and then there could be language on transmission for new reactors. And these are just some of the things that I've been hearing about, but none of them I've seen in writing. So what can you do? Well, first and foremost, I would suggest that you start with Dr. Mark Cooper's new study called The Economics of Nuclear Reactors, and I've got a link here for you as to where you can see that. He is a fellow with the Institute for Energy and the Environment at the Vermont Law School. And this study is really fantastic. He looks at the history of the cost of nuclear power for all the reactors we have existing in the United States and finds that the cost over time, unlike most technologies, it goes up rather than down. Most technologies, iPods, phones, other things, the prices go down over time. With nuclear reactors, the prices went up over time. And then he looks at the studies since the early 2000s up till now that started with MIT, and then utilities started weighing in, and other universities weighed in, and Moody's and other credit rating agencies weighed in about the cost, and found that between the early 2000s and now, the costs also increased. And in fact, the earlier estimates were 4 times lower than they are today. So it is an extraordinary graph to see all of this put out in a graph format. And then he also concludes, after looking at all of this, that the cost of going down the nuclear reactor route is 2 to 3 times more expensive than using renewables and efficiency. And these are numbers totally based on the studies that he reviewed. So essentially, it's a big literature review, and he just crunches the numbers to show that, in fact, nuclear reactors are 2 to 3 times more expensive. There's a lot of other things that you can do. Most importantly, the Congress is not hearing from people about their concerns about nuclear power. Congress is the Senate and the House and Senate are out all the whole month of August. It's a great time to set up a meeting with your elected officials. I highly recommend meeting with your public utility commissions, state elected officials, governor, et cetera, and share this report with them, share any other information you have with them. Make it really clear that this is not a path that you want to go down. right to President Obama. He is going to have a huge say in what this climate bill looks like. You can organize sign-on letters. You can organize public meetings, house parties. We have a one-hour movie that we are trying to get a copy of that we can share with people to do house parties about the cost and risks of nuclear power. You can meet with reporters and ed boards and talk to them about the issues. Find new allies. Who in your state is somebody who hasn't weighed in on this issue, AARP or other entities that really should care about the cost of building new reactors and have not weighed in. And then finally, one of the areas that we've been missing as a community is speaking and participating on online discussions and blogs. And so the more we can weigh in, the more we can educate people. So I'm going to stop there and take questions.
Okay. Thank you, Michelle. I have a number of questions in the list, and I'm going to just run through them as they were submitted. As I said, this is Sarah Barzak again with Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. We also, as I said earlier, have Jen Renick, SACE's Federal Policy Director, to potentially ask any pertinent questions as well. So first, we've got a question thanking us for holding this, and they wanted to find out what the current status and possible expansion or replacement plans for the loan guarantee program. This was from Rebecca Blood. She asked if this is a program that will continue in its current state. Will it be revamped? Does Congress even support a loan guarantee program for new nuclear energy development? To be honest, I think Michelle addressed that question fairly thoroughly. Rebecca, if you want to hone that question down, just send me a finer version. How about this question instead?
Just because it sounds like it wasn't clear, that the Clean Energy Deployment Administration is essentially an expansion of the Title 17 program. And it also, the goal of the program, according to the Senate version, is to take out the decisions away from Congress. And in theory, that sounds great, make them not political. But the reality is that you're talking about giving this decision to 9 unelected people who are not accountable to the public. And who are accountable to the Senate. So you're setting it up so that there's even less accountability to the public and more pressure from Congress to do what they want them to do. So it's not a depoliticized program as the Senate leaders like, or Senate proponents like to claim. So I just want to make that clear.
Okay. The second question that came in, I like how it's worded. It says, the Senate version seems lame. What are the prospects that the House version will drive changes in the Senate?
The Senate version is very lame. I think there's going to, if the Senate energy bill were to go, were to be exactly the same way it is now and to have to go head-to-head with the House version in conference, which is ultimately what will have to happen if the Senate passes a climate bill, it's going to be an enormous battle between the House and Senate over what gets through. And the issues that I raised on CETA are some of the most important issues. We cannot have the Senate version of CETA look like the House version. But also there's other provisions as well that that are in the Senate version, such as the reprocessing language and other proposals or other provisions that we do not want to see in a final bill. And it will be very much up to members of the public to weigh in and say, no, we're not taking that.
Okay, thank you. A third question that we had is, what should we be advocating for to our congressional delegations? The passage of ACES with a majority of House provisions and the necessary omissions of the Senate unlimited guarantee provisions, or not passing the bill at all? This was something that potentially maybe we could have both Jen and Michelle comment on. Jen, I don't know if you want to start, and maybe Michelle follow up.
Hey, this is Jennifer Renick, the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. Thank you, Sarah. Can you restate the question? A call came in just as you were asking, and
Sure.
Clicked off for 1 second.
Sure. essentially, you know, what should people be advocating for out to their congressional delegations? Should, with the passage of ACES with the majority of the House provisions and the necessary omissions of the Senate, unlimited guarantees provision, or not passing a bill at all?
Well, and that's a good question, and thank you for the person who sent that in. The Southern Alliance for Clean Energy, and I'll be clear here, I'm speaking on behalf of my organization, we do support the ACES bill moving forward as a baseline way of putting caps on carbon dioxide emissions and beginning to rein back the global warming pollution, and certainly for the southeastern United States, where we have only one single state with a renewable energy standard, and that was a modest standard at best here in North Carolina. We do see the renewable energy and in particular the energy efficiency components of this bill as being steps forward. So we are advocating for this bill to move forward. We believe the bill should be strengthened, and we are not alone. There are many, many allies, not just in the environmental movement, but among labor groups, among faith and justice groups that all believe that this bill should be strengthened and should continue to move forward. That is for what's going forward in the House. The Senate, as Michelle said, it is an incredibly lame bill, what came out of Energy and Natural Resources. I mean, it's more than lame. It is bad. It is. There are truly bad provisions. And so we want to, of course, you know, create the perfect unicorn here. We want the best bill that we can get, and we don't want the bad provisions in it. My crystal ball says that in order to pass something from the Energy and Natural Resources Committee, a weaker, very middle-of-the-road bill had to come out. And with a 60-40 vote margin on the Senate floor, there are possibilities for strengthening. I would not say that that is impossible, but I would say that all is not, you know, all hope is not lost. We do have opportunities to strengthen. The other place I would point out that strengthening is possible, and I absolutely applaud all of the things that Michelle said there at the end. There are lots of ways to plug in and get your voices heard on this. If and when we have bills that have actually passed both chambers, the conference committee process will be yet another opportunity, unfortunately an opportunity that could weaken, but hopefully an opportunity that would strengthen. And once again, because Democratic leadership controls both chambers of Congress, they would also control the conference committee process. Now, as Michelle pointed out, one of those leaders is Senator Tom Carper, and he is a Democrat, and he is one of the ones advocating for more nuclear energy provision. So, yeah, this is most clearly not a partisan thing. So I think the voice is being heard loud and strong now, and certainly through the recess is going to be the important thing to get, you know, the bill we want and to have the bad provisions left. Excuse me.
Great. Thank you, Jen. Michelle, did you have anything you wanted to add to that?
I just wanted to say that Physicians for Social Responsibility did not take a position on the House ACES bill. We felt strongly that the coal provisions were too weak, but wanted to see the process go forward. So we did not take a position either for or against the bill. We feel very, very strongly that this bill needs to be strengthened, and I am not as optimistic probably as Jennifer that it will get strengthened. What I see the number one role for this community is to focus on advocating for the House version of the CDUP bill, and as equally importantly as advocating against anything else getting added into this bill.
Okay, great.
And nuclear subsidies, I should say.
Great. There's a question. Can Michelle review the change in the law so that taxpayers share the subsidy cost with the borrowers? That was sort of in the middle of your presentation, I think.
Yeah, let me go back and see if I can find that. Okay, I think this is the slide that they're referring to. So existing law requires under Title 17. So we already have a loan guarantee program set up. The problem is it was set up in 2005, and only one conditional loan guarantee has been given out to a solar project. No other loan guarantees have been given out. Why is that? Because they gave it to the Department of Energy that had zero experience, or at least current staff, who had any idea how to do this program. So they basically started from less than ground zero and trying to develop this program. And they got into a huge discussion with the Congressional Budget Office, which is supposed to be, whose job is to protect the taxpayers, right, to protect the Treasury. And fortunately, CBO has been doing its job, fortunately for us as taxpayers. And so there's been years, like I think 2 years of discussion about how they were going to do this. They had to go through a whole rulemaking process, and all of this took a lot of time. And so only now are they starting to talk about giving out all of these loan guarantees. But with the new administration, the new Secretary of Energy, again, they went back to the CBO and said they want to streamline the licensing process. So again, there's another delay. I think that we are expecting to see some announcements in August. So it sounds like that they're working those problems out, hopefully not to the detriment of the U.S. taxpayer. But all of this has been done in complete and utter darkness when it comes to the public. Although the Obama administration has promised to be more transparent, this has not happened in this program, unfortunately. And so we've got this very not functional loan guarantee program. But I think that from my perspective, I certainly advocate for taking the time necessary to set up a program that won't wipe out the bank being, in this case, the Treasury Department, and taking the time to do it right rather than just throwing loan guarantees out the door willy-nilly, which is what the Senate really, really wants. The Senate has been, every time Secretary Chu comes to testify on the Hill, he gets a ton of pressure about when he's going to give out these glorious loan guarantees. Loan guarantees are extremely popular in Congress because they look like free money, and until, of course, the bill comes due. And everyone thinks they're going to get a loan guarantee in their district, every single member of Congress. Now, we would go bankrupt as a country if we gave out loan guarantees to every single district in the country, not just for nuclear, but for all of the technologies that are eligible under Title 17. So the CETA is trying to fix the problems of the Title 17, when in fact it's going to make the problems, I think, in some cases, much worse. And so there are two particular changes that increase the risk for U.S. taxpayers. And in the existing Title 17 law, either the taxpayers pay the subsidy cost, so this for some percentage of whatever the loan guarantee is that's supposed to cover the default if there is one, either the taxpayers are supposed to pay or the borrower pays. The borrower is the company that's getting the loan guarantee. And the idea that when Title 17 was passed was, this program isn't going to cost us anything because all they're going to be the industry is going to be putting in the subsidy cost, and when there's a default, that subsidy cost will pay the default, and the taxpayers will never ever have to pay out a dime. But again, that requires that the subsidy cost is calculated exactly correctly, and that is extremely difficult to do. The other problem is the subsidy costs, according to it's a black box essentially of calculations. We don't really know how they do it because they won't make it public about how they calculate the subsidy cost. It actually turns out that the subsidy cost is much higher than companies are willing to pay. So, for example, I was hearing that for some biofuels projects, they were asking for 24% of the in cash in advance. Well, the companies had no interest in paying out that kind of money in advance. So if you're talking 24% of a nuclear plant, you're talking billions of dollars at that point. And I, again, do not believe that the nuclear industry has any intention of giving the U.S. government $2 billion, $3 billion in advance, just to get a loan guarantee. So the bill changes that language so we can share that subsidy cost. So some portion of it taxpayers pay and some portion of it the borrower pays. And my guess is probably that the taxpayer will pay the significant portion simply because that's how it usually works out. The other increased risk for U.S. taxpayers is this idea of right of lien. So when you default on your house, and then your lien is the property. The bank gets your property, and they get to sell your property so that they can get back the money that they have borrowed to you. That's the same idea. When a project fails, the U.S. government then gets the assets of whatever's there and gets to sell them so that the taxpayer can get back whatever they're paying out in these guarantees. And the way they changed the language, both the House and Senate changed the language so that the U.S. taxpayer doesn't get the first right of lien, and in fact requires the Department of Energy to do agreements in advance with other entities that have financial stake in the project, because we the loan guarantees are up to 80% of the cost of the project. So somebody else has to cover the other 20%. And we have to make these agreements in advance of giving out the loan guarantees. And that means the U.S. taxpayer is likely to lose out because we're going to be sharing the assets rather than getting all of the assets up until the point of where we actually break even. So those are the two major differences.
Great. And we are nearly wrapping up the webinar. We have a couple more questions. One of them for Michelle, what would constitute an event of default triggering a payment under the loan guarantee? And is there a requirement to first, quote unquote, cure the default? And if so, who would be responsible to, quote unquote, cure that default? So again, first part, what would constitute an event of default triggering a payment under the loan guarantee?
If the company that's building a nuclear reactor, and I'm just using a nuclear reactor as an example, can't pay its loan payments, for example, they have construction problems and are supposed to be done in this month and produce electricity so that they can start paying off their loans, but they've had construction problems and therefore cost overruns and therefore aren't going to start producing electricity for at least another year, they default on their loan payments and U.S. taxpayers start paying those defaults off, those loans off. While the company can't pay. That's one example. If a reactor were built and canceled, for example, because the company decided that it was not worth the money to continue, they still have a loan, and if they decide that they can't pay, decide is probably a flippant way of saying it, but if they can't pay, then U.S. taxpayers are backing them, saying we will pay. So essentially what we're saying is we're telling electricity companies, we're telling utilities who are right now being graded by the credit rating companies is quite high, and telling them, go take extraordinary risks, and we promise to bail you out in the future. As for the second part of your question, I don't know what you mean by cure. The companies do have to have some equity, but the question is how much equity that they actually have to have. And it's, you know, they're saying 20%, but in fact, if it's an 80% loan guarantee, the idea would be that the company would have 20% of its own equity involved in the project. But in fact, they aren't even able to raise that 20% and are going to the French and Japanese governments to get loan guarantees for that other 20%. So there is the nuclear industry has learned from the last time around not to risk any of their own money in these projects. And so all of this is focused on shifting the risk from the investor to the ratepayer and to the taxpayer.
Okay, great. Thank you. I think the person's question was just hoping that there was a cure put in place to prevent this from happening, but I think it's fairly clear that this is quite a problem within the data provision as it stands now. We have two last questions, and then we'll wrap up because we do this over the lunch hour, or try to do it over the lunch hour for most people. The second question from Allison Fisher regarding the Senate CETA, it allows for unlimited loan guarantees, but the initial allocation is $10 billion. It is not clear why they would need any allocation if the intent is to allow the government to underwrite an unlimited amount of loans. Is it 100% coverage? So that part, and then I'll ask the second part of her question.
Okay, so the $10 billion, the CETA is bigger than Title 17. Title 17 is just a loan guarantee program. CETA can do a lot more. They can do all kinds of direct and indirect financial support. So they actually need actual cash on hand to be able to, for example, give money to companies directly. They could do that. They can buy securities. They can buy debt. It's actually what the CETA can do is so much bigger than what Title 17 can do. And Title 17 is just a loan guarantee program. And this actually is a bank of some sort, a venture capitalist company is probably a better way of thinking about it. And in order to do that, you need cash. So that is the difference.
Thank you. And the second part of the question is, if implemented as is, do you think the initial 17 loan guarantee applicants, about $122 billion worth of loan guarantees, will line up for consideration under this new program?
Yes. What will happen, the way the program is set up is that it merges Title 17, if we got the Senate bill. Keep in mind that the House bill is very different. It merges Title 17 with CEDA into one entity after about 18 months. That's required to happen. And it has a stipulation that it is not supposed to interrupt any of the applications that are at hand. So it's supposed to merge them seamlessly. So if you had an application in Title 17 and it got merged to CEDA, all of a sudden you could ask for your application to be reconsidered now that they had the right to give out unlimited loan guarantees.
Okay, great. And then our last question, and just so there have been a number of questions sent to me about accessing the webinar and getting the slides. Those are all going to be available on SACE's website at www.cleanenergy.org. You'll actually receive an email after sign off that will provide that link. But our website is www.cleanenergy.org. Okay, so the last question that we have here is related to concerns about health impacts. The person is asking that the bill or the CEDA components that you talked about, the federal legislation for climate and energy, where there are nuclear provisions, especially reprocessing, should there not be a formal health impact statement required, much as we have an environmental impact statement? So essentially their concern is, was there anything anywhere in here that perhaps would cause further study to be done on the health impacts of things processing?
The reprocessing language does require a generic environmental impact statement, and as part of that, they are supposed to look at the impacts on human health. Unfortunately, it says generic impact statement rather than a programmatic. And this is a really important distinction. A programmatic environmental impact requires them to look at the whole program. So reprocessing isn't just one little facility. It's a lot of facilities and a lot of around in a large. So a programmatic environmental impact statement would require looking at all of those impacts together. A generic, they could potentially get away with looking at one facility and not all the others. So we're concerned about that language as well. But as part of that process, they are supposed to look at the impacts on human health. In the programmatic environmental impact statement for the Global Nuclear Energy Partnership, they did a lousy job looking at public health impacts and essentially dismissed it. So, making them actually do a good job is very challenging.
Okay. Great. We are out of time. Michelle. I'd like to thank everyone for attending today. We're very excited to have the webinar series so we can connect with you on issues. We'll be conducting a survey that we hope you'll participate in. I think when you log off, four short questions will come up, so please fill that out as best as you can. Remember that the audio portion of today's webinar, along with Michelle's presentation, will be available by the end of today on our website, which is www.cleanenergy.org. It's under webinars, which is found under the multimedia tab. And you will also, for participating, there will be a follow-up email that will include the link directly to that. So with that, thank you for attending today. Thank you for your questions. And we appreciate your support of SACE. And thank you, Michelle, and for joining the call.